ordinary speech. It was not just the personal opinion of an important figure. Her sermon was a great and beautifully worded analysis of the Islamic community's situation at that time. The sermon included the most profound Islamic concepts. See how strong her character was.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Round the world with reporters.
A special relationship, a term coined after the Second World War by then-British Prime Minister Winston Churchill to describe his country's close bilateral ties with former colony the U.S., from economic to cultural to military. Decades later, that supposed strong bond seems to exist in all but name.
It was never special. We already discussed the Suez Crisis, where the U.S., you know, basically told Britain to get out of the way, slapped it aside like a little child, a recalcitrant child. Tony Blair was the last British Prime Minister who really put a lot of political capital into this so-called special relationship. The price has been thousands of British soldiers killed, over 457 in Afghanistan alone.
Successive U.S. presidents have dealt serious blows to this transatlantic alliance, from Ronald Reagan, who ordered the invasion of Grenada, a Commonwealth country, when Margaret Thatcher was at number 10, the supposed acme of the special relationship, all the way to Trump and now Biden, who ordered the Afghanistan pullout without consulting the UK.
It gives lie to the idea that there ever was a special relationship. It only existed in the deluded minds of British mandarins and British political elites, because they felt they still wanted to feel that Britain was a great power, and that even though they didn't have an empire, they still retained an empire state of mind. And that has now been blown right out of the water with the fall of Afghanistan.
In a sign of heightened tensions, the reaction from a man who got the UK involved in US-led wars in Afghanistan and later Iraq, and is a great believer in this special relationship. He has called Biden's decision imbecilic.
A policy can't be decided by slogan. It's got to be decided on the basis of a strategy. And that's a different thing. And that's really the purpose of what I was saying.
With or without a strategy, it's happening. As U.S. troops evacuate defeated, so must their British peers, just as they went into the country in September 2001. The Taliban have ruled out any extension of the occupation.
If they are intent on continuing the occupation, so it will provoke a reaction.
The exit from Afghanistan is a chaotic one, and the fury at number 10 over being ignored and humiliated is palpable, offering a window into the state of the UK-US relations.
Theirs is a special relationship perennially skewed in Washington's favor, and where junior partner, the UK, plays the role of obedient sidekick. Syed Pourriza, London.
The Russian President Vladimir Putin held a meeting with King Abdullah II of Jordan on the sidelines of the Army 2021 forum. The monarch arrived in Russia not only to inspect new models of technology, but also to discuss the situation in Syria and Afghanistan. In his welcoming speech, the king said that Russia has always been the element of stability in the region, given the difficulties it faced.
But I think more important, as you alluded to, sir, is the challenges that we have in Syria, which you play, I think, the most stable role in being able to move that process forward. Again, your historic role on the Middle East peace process, having met the new Israeli government, I believe that we could be back to talking about how to improve the lives of the Palestinians. But again, with the strong role that you played in that particular aspect, the chance of maybe getting the Israelis and Palestinians to at least start talking to each other.
Experts believe this means that Russia is again expected to play a similar role. The monarch is one of the influential U.S. allies in the Middle East, and his words could have weight in the White House.
The situation in the Syrian province of Daraa is important now for Jordan, which wanted security assurances and hope for a stabilization of the situation in the area. I think that the Russian side has provided clarifications regarding Russia's position on this issue. Another important topic of the talks was the military technical community, Palestine, and the situation in Afghanistan, where both countries can successfully interact.
King Abdullah is the first Middle Eastern leader to meet with Putin after the Taliban seizure of power. The king spoke about Afghanistan, noting that there are difficulties. It can be understood. The world still does not know how to deal with the Taliban and the takeover. On the eve of the meeting, Putin made it clear that he was seriously concerned about the situation with refugees from Afghanistan who might end up in Central Asia.
We have common borders with post-Soviet republics and there are no visa restrictions. Imagine refugees entering any of these countries. Who are among these refugees? How do we know? There may be thousands or even hundreds of thousands of them, and maybe millions. And we have no visa restrictions with our closest allies and neighbors, and the border is 1,000 kilometers. And what are we going to do about it? This is directly related to the security of Russia. This is directly connected with our citizens.
On Monday, Putin discussed the situation in Afghanistan with the leaders of Belarus, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, and Armenia. They expressed concern about the presence of the Daesh terror group in Afghanistan.
Russia is not expected to interfere in the events in Afghanistan. It has not recognized the Taliban, but it has not evacuated its embassy staff. Moscow says it continues to monitor how events develop in this regard. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Four days, eight work shifts of marathon debates in Iran's parliament to review President Raisi's 19 proposed ministers. And yet, the process is not over. On Tuesday, the proposed ministers of culture, science and interior were up for debate. Based on the parliament regulation, two supporting and two opposing lawmakers speak for or against the nominees. The ministers-to-be then have 30 minutes to defend their qualifications.
Our youth are grappling with unemployment. Our people are living in economic difficulties and the coronavirus has exacerbated these problems. We need to form a new cabinet that's capable of addressing all these issues. And the change starts here in Parliament from our careful studying of the proposed ministers.
Since day one of the vote of confidence sessions on Saturday, legislators have examined the credentials of 16 out of 19 nominees. This as the whole process was slated to conclude on Tuesday with a voting session. Lawmakers say they're trying to be meticulous in examining the credentials of the proposed cabinet members, and that has made the process to take longer than planned.
We went based on the plan, but we decided to hold one more session on Wednesday to review the qualifications and plans of the nominees with better care and precision. So we definitely wrap up the process on Wednesday. We needed more time to examine the plans, the experiences and capabilities of each of the proposed ministers. We are the representatives of our people and have to be meticulous to prevent unqualified people from holding sensitive posts.
Ibrahim Raisi handed his proposed cabinet lineup to Parliament on August 12th, a week after he took the oath of office as Iran's new president. The vote of confidence process is now expected to wrap up with a 24-hour delay on Wednesday, when MPs will vote for or against the nominees. While the final voting is yet to be held in Parliament, we can tell from 4 days of debates that the cabinet lineup will not undergo major changes. Still, we have to wait until late Wednesday to learn who has and who hasn't won Parliament's go-ahead to sit in the ministerial chairs. Yusuf Jalali from Iran's Parliament.
The situation in the Afghan capital Kabul is getting worse as a big chaos is ongoing in and around Kabul International Airport. Thousands of Afghans rushed to Kabul International Airport only a day after Taliban took control of the capital Kabul almost a week ago.
This is a tragedy for every single Afghan national. The U.S. claims that it has spent $1 trillion in Afghanistan. No, they were not after making good governance system in our country. They were only after imposing the current situation on our people and Afghanistan.
Chaos in Kabul Airport has so far resulted in the death of at least 20 Afghans, including women and children. The horrifying situation in and around Kabul International Airport has created a big chaos.
People had heard something about the evacuation of Afghan nationals by the U.S. and other foreign troops from Kabul International Airport. So thousands of them gathered around the airport to get into it. But it was just a rumor because even many passport holders couldn't get into the airport.
This comes as the Taliban blamed the U.S. forces for failing to bring the situation under control in the airport, an issue that, according to the Taliban, has led to the loss of civilian lives. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The hasty and chaotic U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan has rattled the idea that the South Korea-U.S. alliance is as, quote, ironclad, as diplomats say. Analysts suggest that the presence of U.S. forces here in South Korea serves U.S. interests, both in terms of deterring North Korea and for checking the expansion of China's influence. But those U.S. interests didn't prevent former U.S. President Donald Trump from threatening to remove U.S. forces from South Korea to force Seoul to pay more for hosting U.S. troops. South Korea's hosted tens of thousands of U.S. troops on dozens of bases throughout the country since the 1950 to 53 Korean War. As a U.S. ally, Seoul is expected to participate in U.S. missions abroad. Security policy analyst Itae Ho argues South Korea's automatic participation in U.S. conflicts is unjustified.
The National Assembly's approval to dispatching troops to Afghanistan and Iraq indicates that South Korea participates in such wars to support American counterterrorism warfare. And unfortunately, the Korean government does not provide any official evaluation afterwards.
For South Korea, the U.S. failure in Afghanistan provides lessons to the South Korea-U.S. alliance and its strategy of entering and occupying North Korea, if and when Pyongyang is no longer in control.
Even though military forces from all over the world took part, it only showed that taking one country by force is not sustainable. For us, it implies that the current military plan between South Korea and U.S. of invading North Korea when it becomes unstable is in fact unrealistic.
He also suggests the South Korea case is different from Afghanistan, as this country has its own advanced military to deter North Korea, although more emphasis needs to be given to negotiations with Pyongyang. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Pro-Palestine activists in England have caused major disruption once again for Israeli arms manufacturer Elbit Systems in Oldham on Monday, after members of the Palestine Action Group occupied one of Elbit's buildings in an attempt to halt the firm's activities. Press TV arrived on location just hours after the stunt was launched.
This isn't the first time that this particular facility has been targeted by Palestine action, and the group say that they will continue to target sites like this until there is a significant change for the Palestinian issue. Now, they have claimed that they have a long queue of future potential activists lining up to conduct this type of action, and that's because there are many, many people in the general public that feel as if they want to do more for Palestine, and they seem to have reached the conclusion that they have little alternative but to do radical action like what we see taking place behind me in order to force the issue.
As well as occupying the roof, some activists blocked the main road, while others smashed windows before smearing the building in red paint. The colour symbolises the blood of Palestinians killed in Gaza.
These people are saying, here's pots of red paint, we want to stop arms. At some point in time, the arms trade will be as vilified as the slave trade was a couple of hundred years ago, and that's what we intend to achieve through this. Here behind us, many people don't even know it's Elbit because it used to be called Ferranti. It doesn't have a big Elbit sign up. It should have a big sign saying Elbit, killer of Palestinian children. That's the sign it should have outside.
Due to the illegal nature of these protests, the activists will be arrested, some already carted off as we arrived. The activists also risk fines, lengthy court battles, and possible jail time. Yet they keep coming back.
No, Elbit is going to close this factory. I give you that as a promise. Elbit's profits are what we want to hit. Elbit as an organisation we want to hit. Elbit will go away because there is enough protest from the communities of this country outside of its factories to say, we do not want your bombs. We want to free Palestine.
Oldham's site is used to manufacture specialist military products, which have been used in successive Israeli attacks on Gaza. So, while Gaza remains besieged, Palestine action vows to continue, as they put it, occupying the occupiers. Robert Carter, Oldham.
In an interview with the Al-Khanadiq website, the head of Yemen's negotiating delegation for peace, Mohammed Abdus Salam, said the UK presence on Yemen's soil is not new, and Yemenis reject any form of foreign presence on their land, and it is their right to fight those who come to invade the country militarily.
Since the beginning of the war, Yemeni people have rejected the foreign presence in any form and cannot accept that. We have made great sacrifices for our freedom and independence and to clean our land from foreign forces. Today, the world is following what is happening in Al-Mara Governorate. People of Yemen cannot accept the Saudi British occupation of Al-Mara, and we have come to the conviction that armed struggle is necessary to expel foreign forces, whether in Al-Mara or elsewhere.
Regarding the developments in Marib, Abdus Salam said the liberated areas from forces backed by the Saudi-led military coalition in the Western Governorate are equal to the size of two Persian Gulf states. The chief negotiator added that battles are still going on in Marib and other fronts. He said the recent initiative offered by Yemen's Ansarullah movement is the key to end the war that the coalition started against Yemen in 2015, but Saudis have no real intentions to move politically. However, he noted that the initiative is still in force.
The other party must accept the initiative presented by Ansarullah because it establishes a comprehensive political solution. The other party will regret it if they didn't respond to this initiative because it aims to stop the war completely and end the suffering of Yemenis. Unfortunately, Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates are the ones who have the power to decide, and we are ready to talk with the Yemeni parties if they have enough courage to take action by themselves.
Recently, the Saudi-led coalition has intensified its air raids on Marib in what experts describe as a desperate attempt to back the Saudi-backed forces on the ground, as the Yemeni army keeps marking new advances toward the city of Marib.
Experts believe that Ansarullah has the upper hand as the Yemeni army keeps advancing toward the city of Marib. They say Ansarullah's initiative is a great opportunity for Riyadh to get rid of the quagmire it's stuck with its war on Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana.
Seoul Metropolitan Government's Yongsan City Memorial Exhibition Hall is holding an exhibit, July 16th Yongsan. It shows footage for the first time in South Korea of the July 16th, 1950 U.S. bombing of Yongsan, Central Seoul's district, which killed hundreds of civilians. U.S. B-29 bombers sent to destroy military targets like Yongsan Station switchyard also hit civilian buildings. 3 weeks before, on June 25th, the Korean War had broken out and North Korean forces had crossed the 38th parallel, capturing Seoul just 3 days later.
The footage obtained from the U.S. National Archives and Records Administration shows bombs being dropped and bodies strewn on the ground. Videos and photos edited from it are organized under four themes to highlight wartime suffering and healing after the 1953 armistice.
The bombing killed at least 1,587 of Yongsan's 193,000 residents, and 47 B-29 bombers dropped some 1,500 bombs, as this bomber was highly inaccurate and had to drop many bombs.
The event draws many curious visitors from Seoul and Greater Seoul's smaller cities and towns.
I'm glad the footage was released. Forgetting this incident would be a tragedy. We should not ignore or hide an unexpectedly large number of civilian deaths an aerial bombing unintentionally caused.
West of Seoul in Incheon, General Douglas MacArthur's statue overlooks the port where he led the famed September 1950 landing that led to the South recovering Seoul.
Some people criticize him because he did not take, at least this is what they say, enough care to minimize civilian casualties during the bombing of Yongsan Station in 1950.
In his latest speech on the anniversary of Korea's liberation from Japan's colonial rule at World War II's end, the same day Korea was divided, the South's president urged inter-Korean peace, the exhibit's underlying message.
East and West Germany achieved unification after 45 years. Division is the biggest obstacle to our growth and prosperity, a tenacious barrier to permanent peace. Like Germany, we can remove it.
The exhibit, which opened recently on the anniversary of the bombing and will run at least until this year's end, serves as a powerful reminder war must never happen on the Korean Peninsula again. Jennifer Chang, Seoul.
As part of a new plot to seize further Palestinian lands, the Jewish National Fund, a Zionist organization, has initially agreed to allocate $100 million to register the Palestinian lands in East Al-Quds and the West Bank in name of settlers. The new plan could lead to the eviction of further Palestinians from their homes in the West Bank and East Al-Quds. According to Israeli Peace Now Group, the establishment is encouraging settlers to confiscate more Palestinian lands. The Peace Now noted that the right-wing regime of Israel is seeking to seize more Palestinian lands through the Jewish National Fund.
This regime will do anything in its power to first expand settlements and second to annex more Palestinian areas. And now, with the help of this gang establishment known as the Jewish National Fund, Bennett's regime is working to achieve his goal, that is to back illegal settlement construction.
The fund covers about 17,000 properties, most of them inhabited by Palestinians. Observers say this is the same scenario carried out earlier in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah in Al-Quds. Palestinian families are fighting legal battles to prove their ownership of the properties amid Israeli efforts to evacuate them forcefully from their homes.
The policy has been adopted many times in the past. Today, the Zionist organization is seeking to forge documents and displace more Palestinians both in West Bank and Al-Quds. They are after imposing their full control over the holy city.
The Jewish National Fund is a Zionist organization founded in 1901 to buy and develop land in Ottoman and Mandatory Palestine for Jewish settlers. Earlier this year, Israeli media reported that Israeli authorities recruited the Jewish National Fund to secretly buy Palestinian land for settlers. Palestinians warned that the move by the Jewish National Fund is another proof for Israel's attempts to illegally seize more land in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds by forced expulsion of real owners. They say, however, that they will never back down and they will continue resisting these Israeli plans. Mona Qandil, Occupy Ramallah.
the limelight.
Germany is forecast to record its biggest rise in greenhouse gas emissions since 1990 this year, as the economy rebounds from the pandemic-related downturn, according to a report by an environmental think tank. The Berlin-based Agora Energy Wende said the country's emissions would probably rise by the equivalent of 47 million tons of carbon dioxide. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at the Associated Press. The piece is titled, Germany's Set the Biggest Rise in Greenhouse Gases for 30 Years. Germany is forecast to record its biggest rise in greenhouse gas emissions since 1990 this year, as the economy rebounds from the pandemic-related downturn, according to a new report by an environmental think tank. The Berlin-based environmental think tank Agora Energy Wende said the country's emissions would probably rise by the equivalent of 47 million tons of carbon dioxide. The increase means Germany's greenhouse gas emissions will be about 37% lower than in 1990. It had aimed to cut emissions by 40% by 2020 and met the target last year, but only due to the economic downturn. The German government recently pledged to increase efforts to combat climate change and to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to net zero by 2045. The new report by environmental think tank Agora Energy Wende draws on data from the first half of 2021 to forecast total emissions equivalent to 760 to 812 million tons of carbon dioxide for the full year. It also shows a significant increase in consumption of fossil fuels across the building, industrial, and transport sectors in Germany. If confirmed, the German government will be required by law to introduce urgent measures to reduce those sectoral emissions. The environmental think tank Agora Energy Wende receives its funding from the environmental groups such as the European Climate Foundation, as well as the German government.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the spotlight.
Venezuela has submitted a report to the International Criminal Court, the ICC, with evidence of the damage caused by U.S. unilateral sanctions. Lives have been lost, not to mention the economic damage. But Venezuela is not the only country targeted by the U.S. sanctions. Countries like Iran, China, Russia, and Syria are also victims of U.S. sanctions. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how these cruel, inhumane, and illegal U.S. sanctions can be countered, some considered to be crimes against humanity.
The Venezuelan vice president has announced that Caracas has handed a report to the International Criminal Court on the damage caused by U.S. sanctions against the country. Delcy Rodriguez says there are reasonable grounds to show what she called inhumane acts committed by U.S. authorities against the Venezuelan population. She said crimes of murder, persecution, and extermination are some of those acts. The U.S. has stepped up its punitive measures against Venezuela over the past several years. Authorities in other countries hit by U.S. sanctions have voiced similar complaints. Cuba's foreign minister, Bruno Rodriguez Padilla, has slammed Washington's blockade on his country as a massive, flagrant, and unacceptable violation of human rights of Cubans. In June, Iran's then-foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, said the U.S. is after mass-starving the Iranian nation and is committing a crime against humanity. Even inside the U.S., politicians have shown their frustration with Washington's economic measures around the world. In February, a group of 23 congressional Democrats sent a letter to President Joe Biden urging him to review the country's sanctions policy. They argued that the restrictions have led to catastrophic humanitarian consequences in various parts of the world, especially during the coronavirus pandemic. They accused respective administrations of imposing sanctions as a knee-jerk reaction without a measured and considered assessment of their impacts. That was not the first time the U.S. was urged to change its sanctions policy. Human rights groups have time and again called on the White House to end its crippling measures. The UN General Assembly has even been calling on Washington since 1992 to lift the embargo on Cuba. For years, those pleas have fallen on deaf ears. The U.S. says it uses sanctions as a tool for democracy, but those actions are contrary to its claims. They also put a question mark since Washington refuses to condemn, let alone punish, its own allies for the pretexts it cites for other nations. While the U.S. wastes no time in imposing sanctions on countries like Russia, Cuba, Iran, and China, it has rarely done the same to Israel, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and many others with checkered human rights records. Critics say the U.S. economic sanctions act as a weapon of mass destruction and a means of collective and indiscriminate punishment, which affect the health of people and their quality of life, and result in devastating and inhumane consequences.
Our guest joining us in this edition of The Spotlight, we have lawyer, writer, historian, and former U.S. Special Rapporteur on the promotion of a democratic and equitable international order, Alfred de Zayas. Also joining us, international human rights lawyer, Edward Corrigan, who joins us from London, Ontario. Okay, I'd like to welcome you both. Alfred de Zayas, I'm going to start with you. This is a topic that has been talked about but needs to be highlighted again, since Venezuela is highlighting this through a report to the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, the ICC. Evidence of the damage caused by these unilateral coercive measures that the U.S. has leveled against the Venezuelan people, and it says the U.S. has committed crimes against humanity. Do you agree with that? And do you think, if so, will the ICC act on it?
Well, sanctions kill. We all know that. And the United Nations, in particular the Commission on Human Rights and now the Human Rights Council, have repeatedly condemned unilateral coercive measures as contrary to international law and contrary to human rights. The General Assembly has adopted 29 resolutions condemning the embargo against Cuba. When I was special rapporteur, that was the period 2012 to 2018, I already signaled that sanctions could, under certain circumstances, amount to crimes against humanity, under the definition of Article 7 of the International Criminal Court, that is, the Statute of Rome. And I incorporated that into my reports to the Human Rights Council in 2018, and I participated in a panel in the Human Rights Council in February 2020, that was a few days after the then Foreign Minister of Venezuela, Jorge Arriaza, had presented the initial complaint to the chief prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda. At the time, that was on the 13th of February, 2020. Now, Monday this week, the 23rd, Delcis Rodriguez and the new foreign minister of Venezuela presented a complimentary report, actually substantiating further, giving figures of the human damage caused by these sanctions. It's clear that if you are diabetic and you don't get your insulin in time, you die. If you suffer from HIV/AIDS, you don't get your antiretroviral drugs in time, you die. Now, it is proven that these very comprehensive unilateral coercive measures applied against Venezuela have directly caused the deaths of tens of thousands. Professor Jeffrey Sachs of Columbia University in New York and Mark Weisbrot of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., issued a report in 2019 estimating that alone for the year 2018, 40,000 persons had died. Now, as you know, I was the first and rapporteur of the United Nations to go to Venezuela. I had the opportunity of speaking with civil society, with NGOs, with the government and ministers, right. And I received ample information as to the impact of these sanctions, which of course has gotten much worse since I was in Venezuela. I like to compare these sanctions with the medieval sieges of towns, you know, when an army wanted to starve a town to death. So it got encircled and no food came in. That is also not unlike the encircling of Leningrad by the Nazis, 1941 to 1944, which caused an estimated 700,000 deaths. So this is what I think the function of the United Nations, to quantify the damage. UNICEF, for instance, could issue a well-based estimate of the number of children who have died as a consequence of these sanctions, as they did, by the way, in the 1990s concerning the sanctions against Iraq.
Let me just get in on a number that you mentioned in a report that was released back in 2019 and bring you in Edward Corrigan, in which our guest there talked about how as many as 40,000 Venezuelans may have died as a result of these U.S. sanctions. Which made it harder for the ordinary Venezuelans to get access to food, medicine, and medical equipment. That was 2019, 40,000 people. So when you have a figure like that, which is quite incredible and shocking, the question that comes about, aside from the fact that what has been done about it, is the ones who are exercising the sanction, i.e. the U.S. and its officials, is their aim to produce results like that? 40,000 people to die.
Madeleine Albright, when she was Secretary of State in the United States, in response to a question, but you know, that 500,000 Iraqis had died due to the sanctions, you know, just said that that was an acceptable number. And, you know, it was, you know, shocking in its, I guess, you know, for being true, but also for an admission of, you know, sort of that they didn't care of what the impact was on people. What we're seeing is, you know, the medieval siege sanctions issue, I think, is a very appropriate way to compare. But you're looking at the United States trying to enforce on its allies and other people a sort of collective punishment against the civilians in Venezuela, in Cuba, in Nicaragua, Yemen, attacking, you know, putting pressure on China and Russia. Any other country that pursues an independent, you know, political policy. And, you know, this is really an attack on democracy. The government in Venezuela was democratically elected, but the Americans didn't like the results, so then they're trying to punish the people and, you know, killing 40,000, you know, in 1 year. Plus, you know, whenever Bush, there was, the CIA was involved with trying to overthrow Chavez, and the American administration immediately recognized the new regime. So it shows that the support for democracy is a lie. If they don't like the democratic result, they want to change the results and the voters, and they're not really concerned about democracy. They're concerned about, you know, power and what they can exploit economically. Now, the incidents when the coup took place in Venezuela, the coup collapsed. The Venezuelan Air Force said, we're going to bomb you if you don't step down. And, you know, Chavez was reinstated, and the people in Venezuela, you know, secured control of their own destiny. But it made the Americans look quite foolish, quite frankly. But now you've got the Americans hijacking, you know, oil tankers, kidnapping diplomats, which they did recently for Venezuela. They're trying to, you know, use COVID vaccinations and other things as a way of punishing people that don't bow to the American, you know, way of doing things. And of course, the Americans are not interested really in the people in the countries that they're affecting, but they're interested in, you know, getting profits for the shareholders and the multinational companies that are taking advantage of. Somebody described the United States as an oil company with an army, you know, so that is an appropriate designation for oil, but it extends to other corporate areas. And in these cases, they're always extracting money and wealth from these countries for themselves, and their shareholders have little or no concern for the people in these countries themselves.
Okay, well, Alfred Isaias, one of those countries that obviously is suffering in many ways from this is the Islamic Republic of Iran. American officials have always argued, Alfred Isaias, that they don't block activities of financial transactions that relate to humanitarian aid. But we have witnessed, and this is coming firsthand, obviously, given the fact that we're doing an interview from the Islamic Republic, that this is just not the case. Plenty of reports out there, plenty of coverage that we have done that shows that these U.S. sanctions are blocking medical supplies to come into the country, medicine to, in not just for COVID-related issues, but other types of diseases. And Iran has been a victim of these U.S. sanctions in more ways than one, not to mention the economic sanctions and how that has damaged the country. Venezuela, 40,000 deaths the year 2019. You said there's probably more. And Iran, there has been a number of deaths. Why isn't Iran highlighted in that respect, do you think? And what do you think needs to be done in order for Iran's case to come into the picture in the way that it should?
Well, it is in the picture. And when I write about unilateral coercive measures, I mentioned that there are over 30 countries that are under U.S. sanctions, and that these sanctions are not smart sanctions, that these sanctions actually, because of the phenomenon of overcompliance, leads to a complete breakdown of trade. And that impacts all humanitarian aid and impacts medicines, impacts food, etc. Even if it's possible to obtain, theoretically, obtain waivers so that you can import, export into Iran or into Venezuela, it simply does not work in a capitalistic world where an entrepreneur, a businessman, has to estimate his risks. if there is a risk of being sanctioned or being penalized by the Department of the Treasury with $100,000, $200,000, $300,000, obviously a businessman is going to pull out, is not going to do any kind of business, be it with Syria, be it with Iran, be it with Venezuela, and that is the situation that we are living. Now, that is completely contrary to the United Nations Charter, numerous articles of the United Nations Charter. I would like to see the International Court of Justice pick up the issue for an advisory opinion that can be done in the General Assembly by obtaining majority plus one and elevating the legal issue of the illegality of unilateral coercive measures to the International Court of Justice and have the International Court of Justice determine, number one, that of course they are contrary to the United Nations Charter, and secondly, that entails state penal and civil liability, meaning that the United States owes trillions of dollars of reparations to all the countries that have unjustly suffered under illegal sanctions.
Sure.
That, of course, is just law.
Sure.
That's how you're going to enforce it, that's something entirely different.
Of course. And that's great, because perhaps we need to expand a little bit with you, Edward Corrigan, when it comes to how the U.S. says humanitarian supplies, humanitarian aid is exempt. Take the case of Cuba, for example. Just recently, Biden threw its support and weight behind the protesters who had come out, and really because of COVID-19, one of the reasons they came out and protested. But what was really the problem with Cuba, with U.S. sanctions, is something that is not highlighted, and that was what former U.S. President Donald Trump did, aside from calling, I believe, Cuba a terrorist entity. He went and he cut the Western Union offices in Cuba. There were 400 of them, money that came from the U.S. or overseas into Cuba, which is one of the primary sources of revenue, upwards of $1 billion. It cut that. It was a very severe act, not highlighted in a lot of publications. Yeah. And Cuba, you know, how much money does its GDP generate? And they're suffering because of that. Can you please tell us, is the U.S. Lying when it says no, it's exempt? And why doesn't then the U.S. get accused of this or maybe in a bigger picture get prosecuted for it? Because humanitarian supplies are obviously not exempt.
Well, there's a blatant double standard. The Americans use whatever power they can. They see their own, you know, corporations as an extension of their power, and they threaten the corporations, if you don't do this, we're going to punish you in our market. And as a result, Western Union would shut down 1,000 offices in Cuba, which give money to the Cuban people from overseas in the United States and elsewhere. But, you know, it's this extension of corporate power and trying to force other countries to obey the American rules. And, you know, they have a lot of leverage, but it really is they're trying to do a third-party extension of their rules and applying them to other countries. For example, why should Iraq require, you know, waivers from the United States to import oil or gasoline from neighboring Iran? You know, why should the United States be punishing Russia and Europe for building a gas and oil pipeline from Russia into Europe, so that Europe has more diverse supplies and isn't dependent on any one source? The Americans want to have control of that, and they don't want to compete in a fair market value or a fair market system. They want to be able to impose their control and their will, and then extract resources, which invariably, you know, hurts the population. You know, Gaddafi used oil in Libya to, you know, it was one of the highest standard of living, if not the highest standard of living of all of Africa. Everything was subsidized. You know, it was free healthcare, free education, you know, great subsidies for housing, for gas.
Right.
And because, you know, Gaddafi was using the oil resources for the benefit of the people, and other things that the Americans and the British and the French and the Italians and like, they overthrew him. And now the money is going out to, you know, to American and other countries,
sure,
you know, corporations, and the people are deprived of it. I'm sure they'd love to get Gaddafi back, but it's sort of a form of banditry or outright theft of the resources of not only Libya, but other countries.
Okay, we got just a little bit of time here, so I have to address the last question to you, Alfred Desaias. Aside from the fact that statistics out there that show that these politically and ideologically driven sanctions by the U.S. has been not very successful in terms of its stated aims. We could mention Iran, we could mention Venezuela, we could mention Cuba, we could mention Syria. One of the things that it does do is it becomes counterproductive, because you're going to take a look at some of these countries and how they're suffering, what the people actually think of the U.S. And if you have Mike Pompeo, the former Secretary of State, saying, you know, the people of Iran are going to have to suffer from not having food to eat, if and I'm not going to use the words that he used to describe the ruling government. You know, when he says things like that, people are going to come out against the U.S. in terms of what they think of the U.S. And, of course, you know, that's something that I'm guessing is not what the U.S. aim is here. Overall, do you think that the U.S. realizes the sanctions are not really producing the results that they want?
Well, there are plenty of professors like Jeffrey Sachs, like Dan Kovalik, who realize the absurdity of the sanctions policy. It is a completely failed model. Take Cuba. It's been 60 years of sanctions, and the Cuban people have not risen to overthrow the current regime of Díaz-Canel or of the Castro brothers, etc. The fact is that, as Julius Caesar used to say, quae volumus ea credimus libenter, that which we want to believe, we do believe. And people like Pompeo, like John Bolton, like Trump, they live in their own world. Uh-huh. Live in their own world.
Sure.
They don't realize that we Americans, and I am an American citizen,
okay,
that we Americans are hated.
I'm so sorry. I got to jump in here because we're just out of time. I do apologize. Time just got the best of us. Alfred Desaias there. Thank you so much. Lawyer, writer, historian, former U.N. Special Rapporteur. Thank you, Edward Corrigan, international human rights lawyer from London, Ontario. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks so much for tuning in. For me, Kavitawa, the entire team is goodbye. Until next time.